I've treated my life like this. Life is like biryani. You move the good stuff towards you, and you push the weird shit to the side.
For those of you who didn't get it, look it up and then start laughing, because that is the best thing.
From First Look Media and Panoply, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu, and I'm your daddy.
Ew. The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
They're paying us to try to make sense of something you can't make sense of.
It's the ultimate scam. It's the ultimate scam. It's the ultimate scam. On today's show, we're talking to my friend, Hasan Minhaj.
He's our friend, and I'm being generous. He's really my friend because we're both South Asian. So if he needs bone marrow, who's he going to go to?
Bone marrow is how you define friendship?
Yeah, if you need bone marrow, yeah, that's exactly how you define friendship.
Good point.
Hasan is a comedian and performer best known for his work as a correspondent on The Daily Show, where he is absolutely killing it.
It's true. Hasan has made it clear that this is not your grandfather's Daily Show, or even Jon Stewart's Daily Show anymore. He and Trevor Noah are literally changing the face of The Daily Show.
Like the time he visited DJ Khaled, the record producer, Snapchat celebrity, and notable maniac to talk about their nicknames for their favorite shoes.
I call these the Red Sea. I call these You Wish You Hollered At Me Now, Janice Marlowe.
I call these Don't Ever Play Yourself.
I call these Oregon, but don't sleep on the Pacific Northwest.
I call these Hotline Bling.
I call these Canada's greatest.
You may also have heard about his appearance earlier this year at the Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner. It was shortly after the Orlando shooting, and he addressed Congress's inaction on any kind of gun control.
I just gotta ask you this, look. When I got into comedy, when you guys got into media, and when you guys got into politics, we wanted to do the best work we could possibly do. And is this what you want your legacy to be? That you were a could-have-done-something Congress, but you didn't because of outside lobbying? That you were complicit in the deaths of thousands of Americans? And look, I know being a member of Congress is hard. You got to placate your base. You got to look out for re-election. You got to answer to lobbyists. But please, persevere, because our thoughts and prayers are with you. Good night.
Mic drop alert. Mic drop alert. Mic drop alert.
Hasan is also currently touring his amazing solo show called Homecoming King. It's based on his experiences growing up as a first-generation Indian American and the story of quote-unquote New Brown America.
It's fantastic. You should go see it, and make sure if you see him after the show to remind him I am a better friend to him than Kamau.
I guess you did see the show and I didn't, so I guess you won this round. Damn it! I hate when I lose the friend game to Hari. On the ball!
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Hari, what's up, man?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. Other than all that, all those hate tweets for apparently endorsing Jill Stein. Other than that, things are... I didn't endorse Jill Stein. I just said I was going to vote for her.
You're a celebrity. That's an endorsement, I hate to tell you.
Yeah, so I got grilled pretty bad by our fans about voting for Jill Stein. And they claimed I endorsed Jill Stein, which, by the way, I don't endorse political candidates. That's a thing that I will never do. But I said I was going to vote for her, but mainly because I support the Green. But no offense to Jill Stein, but mainly this is about the Green Party and supporting the Green Party. And I got grilled for like, oh, she's a anti-vaxxer, which I don't think she's an anti-vaxxer. My understanding is her big thing is that the FDA is handcuffed by the medical industry, which we know, and vaccines are part of that industry. And I think we should be, you know, they should be regulated carefully. I mean, I think that's a reasonable stance. It's not against vaccines. Vaccines are extremely important. We should be taking vaccines. And so my understanding of that was that she doesn't, you know, that she feels that there should be, we should have safety regulations, and we should be suspicious of something that's run by the medical industry, the fact that money is invested. I think that's fair, and I think a lot of us would have that stance on most things. And then the other thing regarding Wi-Fi, I don't think it's that Wi-Fi causes diseases or cancer in children. I think it's what impact does Wi-Fi have on children? Are there enough studies? Are we sure, since Wi-Fi isn't that old? Again, I don't think it's that she's a maniac who thinks we shouldn't be taking vaccines and that Wi-Fi is killing children. I think it's more nuanced than that, and that's how I viewed it. I'm not Alex Jones. I'm not out of my mind. I just think that, like, there is a maybe a nuanced take on this. And with regards to her own, Jill Stein's investments and things that she's against, and her hypocrisy potentially. I mean, I think if you Google Hillary Clinton, you'll find a fair number of things that are true and untrue, and also don't paint her in the best light. So for me, it's not so much about the candidates in this regard. It's really about having a system with multiple parties. And that's what I stand for. And I live in a state where I can vote for Jill Stein and really the Green Party and feel like I'm contributing to the changes I want to see in democracy.
Well, yes, I think that's well
said. So leave me alone.
that's well said, Hari. You know, I think that when people are suspicious of someone, they certainly find ways to be. They find things that make them seem more suspicious. It's, you know, confirmation bias, I think, is what it's called. Also, I think, you know, and therefore some people thought, like, maybe if you're trying to recruit people to your cause, that you don't quote a guy who's thought of as being a child molester as being one of the great 20th century philosophers.
The Woody Allen reference she made, I was not happy about. I was like, what are you doing, Jill Stein?
That's when I was like, because I was like, wait, are we talking about the same Woody Allen? And she said yes. And I was like, okay.
I was hanging out with my friend Roman Polanski, listening to a Bill Cosby record, and we were talking about how great Woody Allen was. Hey, is that R. Kelly? I love R. Kelly. Yeah. Stop it.
I thought, again, like Rosa Clemente said, there's the Green Party platform has a lot of things I'm super excited about. To me, it's like, but if you know you're a member of a party that is marginalized, you have to be super careful about things that will make it easy for people to marginalize you. And one of those things is quoting Woody Allen. But, you know,
I'm not saying the Green Party is perfect, and I'm not saying Jill Stein is perfect, but I do think we need to push. And I think maybe some of those imperfections come from the fact that they're terribly underfunded and we don't really support third parties. So, you know, that's what it's about to me. I think Rosa Clemente also talks about the racism within the Green Party being an issue, which is definitely true between the Democrats and Republicans, too, all the way, because this country is racist.
Yes.
But I think we should be thinking about ways to expand democracy that in a way that's fair, that takes corporate interests out, and where we can be critical of all candidates, where we're not choosing between two evils all the time. And if you live in a state, I'm not even talking about voting for the Green Party, but if you live in a state where you can vote for the Green Party safely, maybe you should. Maybe that would be a positive thing to do.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not talking to you, Ohio and Florida.
And Pennsylvania, and maybe not even Texas.
But California, maybe think about it.
California,
Massachusetts, there's a shot there.
Well, that's what I was saying. I think if I was the Green Party's presidential candidate, I would just be saying, hey, help us get to 5%. Like, that's all I would be saying. It wouldn't be about, I want to be president. It'd be like, if we get to 5%, we have a chance of being a legitimate party in this country. So help a 5%er out. So actually, I think maybe I'll run for president for the Green Party next time.
Seed planted.
And dug up and thrown in the trash. Also, in an unrelated note, SE Cup said 98% of Americans pray every day. I looked that up. That's not right. But anyway, just wanted to wrap that up. That's been bugging me. But anyway, yes, we have had two episodes in a row that have caused listeners of our podcast to feel all the feels. If we go back to SE Cup, that caused a lot of feels. And then last week with Dr. Jill Stein, that caused all the feels. So this week, I think we're going to be on good footing with our listeners. We have a lot going on in this episode. It's the most packed episode we've ever had. The main guest is from The Daily Show, Hasan Minhaj, who we know from back in the day. He's one of the people who is responsible for The Daily Show's new direction, along with Trevor Noah. There's a whole basically new cast there at The Daily Show. So he's an old friend of ours. He's got a one-man show called Homecoming King. He's a great dude. I think our listeners will agree with him politically. But then also, we have a couple extra added bonuses. We are in the middle of, I think, what your people call the World Series. By that, I mean baseball fans.
It's a special time for us.
Yes, it's the harvest season for baseball. For people who don't know how baseball works, this is the season where they harvest all the baseball that they've been planting all season.
It's like Burning Man for baseball.
It's Burning Man for baseball, and it's currently the Chicago Cubs, who haven't won in a very, very long time, versus the Cleveland baseball team, who hasn't just won in a very long time. And so it's these two baseball teams who haven't won in a long time, and they're historic teams, I guess, if you count baseball history as being history. And there's some controversy. Hari, would you like to pick it up from there?
Yeah, it does count as history because time passed and there are records of it. So yes, baseball history is history. And yeah, it is historic because the Cubs have made their first World Series since 1945. And if they win, they'll win for the first time since 1908. And if Cleveland wins, it'll be the first time since sometime in the 50s. Honestly, I don't really remember the year because I'm not rooting for them because of their racist name and symbol. By the way, yeah, the name is racist too, because it'd be weird if the team was called the Cleveland African Americans, because those are human beings. You're describing human beings.
So it's just a very interesting time in history because not only is the Cleveland Indians, which I'll say for the purpose of explaining this, not are they in the World Series, but their mascot, Chief Wahoo, is just, it should be in the dictionary under racism, Chief Wahoo, his caricature of a Native American who never existed. And so not only is that happening, but it's happening at the same time that in North Dakota, on the Standing Rock Reservation, tribes from all over the world, country and the world, are coming together to stand up against the government trying to seize treaty land. So the fact that these things are happening at the same time, now I sound like Alex Jones. It sounds like but it's not a conspiracy. It's actually really happening, and it's a really interesting time to be talking about these things. So we have two special guests. One is the editor-in-chief of Cleveland Scene, Vince Gregoric, and he wrote an article as a fan of Cleveland. He's from Cleveland, as a fan of the baseball team there, about how they have to let the mascot go. After that, we're going to call Sterling Holy White Mountain, who is a member of the Blackfeet tribe in Montana. And he's somebody who grew up on a reservation, was a fan of the Cleveland Indians baseball team. And he's going to talk about how he came to realize that was not a good thing. And he's also going to help us connect it to the struggle going on the Standing Rock Reservation. We're here with Vince Gregoric from the Cleveland Scene. And I just want to say what I feel like you are, Vince, is a white guy who's embarrassed about the Cleveland Indians mascot.
That is true.
So, which makes you kind of a national hero, and you're from Cleveland.
Yeah, and the target of much scorn over the past week, for sure, and ever since. I mean, my paper's been writing about this for years now, so the responses are not surprising at this point.
Why do people hold on to this so much? Because I haven't gotten this, whether it's from the Indians or the Blackhawks or the Redskins or might get the Braves. It's so strange to me, because if your team wins a championship with a different name, are people really going to be like, man, this championship is great, but I completely miss that disembodied indigenous man's head that used to be on the hat?
I mean, it's really weird. It's super weird to me. And you know, in defense of my city, a lot of people here, you know, there's a very vocal support system for Wahoo. There was a protest Tuesday outside before the game, and one of my staff writers went. He said this middle-aged woman walked up to the group of Native Americans protesting and put her hand over her heart, and said, "I love Chief Wahoo. He's my man." They're like, "That's not a real person."
Oh,
we are. And she's like,
God.
"No, he is," and just walked away. It's super strange.
It's one of those things where people have fundamental like people act like it's just a difference of opinion about things that are like, well, that's not. It's like people go, "Well, I just don't believe in the theory of gravity." Well, that's not actually a thing you get to believe in. It's not actually
right.
Your choice. This is how the universe is governed. And I feel like this with like, there's no such person as Chief Wahoo. And the way that you've drawn him is not the way anybody looks. And Native American tribes don't believe this is respectful.
No, and my favorite middle ground defense is the people who say, like, well, I can understand both sides, and I can see how some people find it offensive, but that's just not me. And it's like, Well, that's like saying like that noose is offensive to people, but I can appreciate the craftsmanship in it.
Right, right.
That's definitely a sentence somebody has said before, by the way. That's definitely
right.
So talk about the Cleveland is in the World Series. It's a big deal. It's been quite a long time. So I'm sure there's a lot of like people who are just like, can't we just have fun and talk about this in a few weeks? Why do you think it's important to talk about it now?
Yeah. Oh God, our comment section and Facebook are just, you know, littered with that. Like, seeing, why do you have to ruin this parade? You know, can't we just deal with this later? Which, you know, dealing with it later. So, I mean, these protests happen every opening day in Cleveland, and there's been some notable ones, right? 2 years ago, there was the kind of infamous picture of the red-faced guy talking to the Native American, and that went kind of viral. And, you know, in the guy's defense, his name is Pedro Rodriguez, who had the red face. You know, he had discussions later on and was like, I'm never doing that again. That was wrong of me, and I changed my mind. But so every opening day, there's these protests, and to deal with it later usually means, hell, give us another 364 days, and then we'll ignore you. But, you know, we're on the biggest stage in American sports right now, and it's, you know, I think a good time to have a larger conversation, and there's more people paying attention.
I think it feels like it's in the best, and I feel like I realize the thing I'm about to say is going to lose a lot of our fans from Cleveland. But I feel like it's in the best interest of Cleveland for the Indians to lose the World Series. And I say
Chicago
that,
Cub fans, guys, Chicago Cub fans are going to claim like, yeah, that makes sense to us too. That makes sense.
But don't you want to hear my argument, Chicago Cubs fans? No, I think it makes sense. I think it's because in about like maybe 10 years, 5 years, 30 years, who knows, people are going to look at this championship team and see that stupid logo and have to deal with the fact that this was one of the finer moments in Cleveland sports history and it's tainted by it, as opposed to if you all win in, let's say, 5 years and this mascot's gone and you win with just a C on your caps. I feel like that's a much cleaner way to celebrate something without the taint of blatant racism.
I don't think there's many people who would support the argument here, fandom-wise, but there are certainly some. And so the problem is that Larry and Paul Dolan speak for the organization, right? They own the team. They speak for the organization, but they don't speak for everyone at that organization. Like Mark Shapiro, you know, our former president and GM, you know, now up in Toronto, you know, as this kind of playoff push happened and, you know, the Blue Jays announcer said, listen, I don't use the word Indians when I'm talking about the team. Mark Shapiro came out and said, in retrospect, not even in retrospect, like now I can freely say I'm personally bothered by Wahoo and I was at the time. That's why I started to push for the Block C. So, yeah, I mean, you can punish everyone in Cleveland, all the fans and God knows how many hundreds of people that work for the team. But really, it's Paul and Larry Dolan's call. And Larry's on record as recently as about a decade ago saying, I firmly reject that Wahoo is racist. And I don't know what conversations the commissioner is going to have with him where that's going to change, but that's where it rests.
Oh, that's so weird. He's smiling to keep from crying. I mean, it's a ridiculous image. If you look at any minstrel image ever throughout the history of this country, he has that smile. It's so bizarre.
The last question we'll ask him, we'll let you go, because, you know, there's a lot of things going on in Cleveland, is wouldn't the best thing to do and the most popular way to get out of this is just to name the Cleveland baseball team the Cleveland LeBrons? Wouldn't everybody be happy with that? Wouldn't that be the cleanest way to get out of this? And everybody, who could argue with that? LeBron has definitely redefined what Cleveland is.
Akron.
And I feel like
Akron can argue with that.
Yeah. How could anybody argue with the Cleveland LeBrons? That would be the number one jersey seller in the world and the number one hat. And you could just put a picture of LeBron's smiling face, which you already have plenty of pictures of those. You don't have to even cartoon it up.
No, they should do that. I mean, I don't think they're going to change the name. I mean, at this point, I really don't, especially if they win the World Series, even though it'd be the best excuse to.
Wow.
I mean, if the owner admits 10 years ago he doesn't think Wahoo is racist, I can only imagine what he thinks about the name. And it's not in honor like the Seminoles, right? It's a completely different situation. So, I mean, my guess was...
It's honoring a mistake that Columbus made.
Right. I mean, maybe they take it off the official uniform and sell it in the team shop. I mean, I appreciate, and obviously I've written about this week. There's been a lot written about Wahoo, and that's tremendous. Judging by online reaction, it hasn't changed many minds. But That doesn't mean it won't in the future.
Well, Vince, thank you for letting us call you in the middle of hectic times for Cleveland people. We appreciate it. And thank you for being a white guy who's against racism. We appreciate that.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So that was the white guy from Cleveland's perspective.
Let's say that's a white guy from Cleveland's perspective, because I have a feeling that does not reflect many of the white guys from Cleveland on this particular issue.
Good point. Why don't we get an actual Native American's perspective on this? Let's talk to Sterling Holy White Mountain of the Blackfeet tribe. Hello, Sterling.
Okay. That's Blackfoot for hello.
Okay.
But it really what it means is it's like, you know, I'm 70% sure that I like you, but we'll see how the rest of this goes.
In case we're calling to talk you down from, like, we're calling to go, I mean, it's not such a bad name, right, Sterling? You really, you don't feel the hit.
Yeah.
We're calling to talk you out of your position. Nah, I mean, we read the thing. It was nice. But come on, it's not that bad, right, fella?
Right, fella.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's great.
Thank you for letting us call you last minute. I read your ESPN article, and right as we were going into record right now, and I was like, we got to get this guy. So this literally happened over the last hour on Twitter. So thank you for being available.
Yeah, for sure, man. Thanks for getting me. You know, I think because of you, I picked up about 15 followers in the last hour, and I think that's more than I've gotten in the last year. So I'm feeling pretty good about things right now.
So talk about your – the thing I think is interesting about the article, you talk about how you grew up being a fan of the Cleveland baseball team and sort of like your realization about the name. So talk about that.
I mean, I was as much a fan as I could be given where I grew up. Like, baseball is really non-existent here. And so, like – but for whatever reason, my friends and I still, like, pick teams. And I picked the Indians. And like I said in the article, I'm not entirely sure why. I think I know why, but, you know, I was 12 or 13. And there was a brief time that there was that brief period in my life where I'm pretty sure that I thought Wahoo was cool too, which is kind of funny now, but it's, you know, like, you know, I was 14. I didn't know any better. I think I started to figure this stuff out when I first moved off the reservation, actually. I moved off reservation, and after spending most of my life, or the first 18 years of my life, largely surrounded by Blackfeet people, then all of a sudden I'm in, you know, I'm at the University of Montana, and I'm one of the only American Indians on campus, and that was when I started to figure stuff out. Like, I had guys that lived down the hall from me that called me Chief all the time, and I didn't really understand that, you know, And I also figured out that, like, white people don't laugh very much. And, like, you know, and I was like, man, no wonder these guys are so miserable.
Yeah, so, Kamau and I have had that at our shows as stand-up comedians as well, but I think it might be different reasons. But, yeah. Can you summarize some of the major points of the article? And also, you know, tell us a little bit of how this relates to DAPL, to No DAPL.
The article is a summation of stuff that I've been talking about with my other, my other Native friends for the past like 3, 4, 5 years. When the mascot debate really hit it big, like, we were actually taking at that moment in time, like right when it blew up, like I was in a tribal sovereignty course, and so all we were talking about was like tribal sovereignty, and we would just sit around and go like, why is this issue not being connected to something more than racism? So, I mean, the article to me is about like how was me trying to find some way to connect Wahoo to these issues of tribal sovereignty, which are so significant in Indian country, but never get any airtime. And speaking of the Dakota Access Pipeline, I don't know if it's like this for African Americans, but like there's Facebook, and then there's like Indian Facebook. So there's like this whole conversation that happens on Facebook that's only almost exclusively between American Indian people. And so, like, I don't know if anybody else even knows what's going on at Standing Rock right now. I mean, it's because the U.S. media has covered this stuff so poorly, but you know, yesterday they removed, they forcibly removed all those water protectors from blocking that, the pipeline route. And they did it with, you know, like military force. Like they those guys, where they were located at that moment in time when they, before they moved them, that's treaty land. Like that's land that according to treaties belongs to those, not just the, well, belongs to the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota people, but then there are also some other tribes that were included in that treaty that I'm not entirely aware of how many there were, but primarily that's Lakota land. And and the way the treaties, my friend was just talking about this on Facebook today, like treaties are like violating treaties is like, that's a federal offense.
Wow.
It's just that, yeah, it is. It's just like,
if you're the,
like
if you're the feds, you don't have to worry about making federal offenses, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, like you have to, the way I wish we could, you know, reorient this conversation is to think of these viol-, because everybody knows, like, I think the phrase kind of, you know, the Indians got ripped off. Right. And then that's kind of like that's a feeling, but it doesn't really say very much. But like, if we could reorient that towards like, well, actually, like treaties were broken and treaties are only signed between nations. That's why the U.S. does not have treaties with states, right? Because the United States created the states, but the United States did not create us. We were here before that. And so they had to sign treaties with us. And then they broke those treaties. And so that's a really serious offense in international law, right? But we don't think about it that way inside the United States. And so those guys were removed from land that their own land yesterday is what happened. And that's...
To sort of put it in sort of terms that maybe even us new Americans can understand, it would be as if we told Canada, back up.
Exactly. Like yeah. Canada. Totally. No, that's yeah, absolutely. That's how I was, you know, I was talking about it with somebody the other day, and I said, you know, we got to think about this stuff in terms of like, this is the equivalent of the United States telling Canada, like, you guys have to go back like 5 miles because this is ours now.
which destroys the idea of sovereignty. Then you're not a sovereign nation if another nation just sort of decides
absolutely
to take parts yep of your land when they want it.
Absolutely. So my issue with the way that the Dakota Access Pipeline has been framed is that it has been framed kind of ahistorically, like as if there is no history behind it, and this is just like a group of Indians that are in the way, right? And like, oh my God, like they're illegally trespassing. And I'm like, no, actually, they're on their own treaty land. And and that, like, this whole conversation with regards to that particular area of the pipeline, that needs to be framed in terms of sovereignty.
Thank you so much for being on our podcast, and we really did want to discuss this, and it feels like it's always the perfect time to discuss, but especially right now. So, you know, thank you again for being on.
Yeah, of course, man. I appreciate it.
And thank you for connecting. I think the big thing too is connecting the Cleveland baseball team problem of the mascot and the name to the Dakota Access Pipeline. I think that's something that people aren't doing, or at least I'm sure it's happening on Native American Facebook, but it didn't happen on regular Facebook, brother.
Nope.
Yeah, I think if I could just say one more thing, it's that
absolutely,
you know, Wahoo looks is to me is like it's a symbol of all the things that like that America refuses to acknowledge about its history. It's the history of its relationship to American Indians. And, you know, and then like when people are saying like, you know, oh, we're honoring you, like, no. Like, not only is it disrespectful, but the way you honor us is by honoring our treaties.
Well, yeah. Thank you. It's funny. We just talked to a Cleveland sports writer who wrote a piece about how offensive the Wahoo mascot is. And he was like, I don't think, because all this comes down to a couple owners of the team. And he's like, they may change Wahoo, but they're not changing the name. And it just feels like we can't actually just focus on Chief Wahoo. We have to focus on the whole thing.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Braves too. And I'm like, man, like this is, it's you know, once you recognize it, it's like, you know, once the light goes on, it's so fucking obvious. You're like, what in the fuck is going on here? that's you know, that's what it's like. Like when the light goes on, you're like, holy shit.
What? I think that summarizes it best, is better than we can. What in the fuck is going on here? But thank you, Sterling, for letting us call you.
Yeah, man. I really appreciate it. You guys have a good night.
Man, it was really great to talk to Sterling and see that connection between images and also what's going on right now with the No DAPL movement.
Yeah, and sort of to bring something in from my other podcast, Come Out Right Now, on that, the last episode of that podcast, I recommend you listen to, we actually talked to Cody Hall, who is at Standing Rock. He's a member of Red Warrior Camp. Red Warrior Camp is the direct action arm of the Water Protectors. They actually go out and do the direct actions to try to stop the pipeline. And they have a GoFundMe that I'm going to recommend you go fund. They're just trying to raise money, and most of this money actually apparently, or a lot of this money, is going to their legal defense because many of them have been arrested. Some of them have been arrested more than once, and they need money for their legal defense bills. So you can go to GoFundMe.com/Red Warrior Camp. That's all one word. And you can donate them some money to help them with their legal bills because, as I learned when I talked to Cody Hall and as I've learned when I was actually in North Dakota, they're actually fighting for the water for all of us, not just for their land rights or for their own water for their community. It's actually the water for all of us. Because I don't know if you know this, Hari, but the water that's in the ground actually connects to all the other water that's in the ground.
Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah.
It's weird. Did you get a master's in science?
Yes, I have a master's in water, which is actually probably a real thing, but not true about me. And now we will go to our interview with Hasan Minhaj, an old friend of, I guess, both of ours.
Yes.
Who we've known since he started doing comedy in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's from Davis, California, but moved down to San Francisco to do comedy. And we'll talk about how we got to meet. The work he's doing, all the amazing work he's doing, and the evolution of his comedy voice.
This is a really fun interview, and it was so nice to hang out with an old friend.
Yes, it was nice to hang out with an old friend.
He's actually younger than we are. I could start. I thought we'd start with like personal, like because we're friends stuff, unless you want to start.
No, we can do that. Can I start then? I have a thing.
Yeah, you start because you're over there. So you start first.
Yeah, because then you guys are going to start talking and then I'll dub myself in later like you did with me. And
it's not. Mm-hmm.
Damn, I love this.
It's already started.
This is some family stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. So what's up, Hasan? How's it going, man?
Man, I'm living life. I'm so happy to be. I wish we were all in the same room together. That's really why I wanted to do this.
When was the last time that happened? When were we all in the same place at the same time last?
When you guys were doing the show.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was that long ago.
I thought it was even longer than that because I think Kamau and I have blocked out some of that time.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. I don't remember major stretches of Totally Biased. That's the show you're referring to. There's times when people are like, yeah, I was told. There was sometimes somebody's like, I was on your show. I was like, you were?
I do it like the Lord Voldemort rule. It's the show that shall not be named.
Oh, well, oh. Thank you.
Yeah. No, you know what? No, man, don't say that, man. You guys were the first ones that did Sheik versus Sheik. That was so baller.
I remember when that show was a weekly show, what was great is that it really felt like a team effort. Like all the writers, because, you know, it was a week. We all got really close. A lot of us were first-time writers, and it felt like we all put everything we had into that, and it felt like a family. It was great.
Yeah. Well, let's take this back to you, because we could talk more about things that happened in my career. But it's funny, the time I remember us actually being together was around the same time that I first started becoming friends with Hari, was we all went to dinner at a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco.
You
remember that?
Yeah, I just remember tagging along, though.
Yeah, well, that's you were tagging along. At the time, I was like, what's this dude doing coming?
I know, man. Yeah, I could. And, oh, man, so my insecurity was right. I just felt.
Not really. Here's what I remember. I just remember I knew you, but I didn't. We had never gone out together. And I was excited to go out with Hari, but so were you. And so it wasn't a problem. It was just like this thing. It was like, me and Hasan have never, ever hung out together. And what I do remember, and this wasn't annoying at the time. It sort of was revealing to me of things I didn't know, is how, like, that. I think that was the first time I heard the name Russell Peters.
Oh, what? Man, really?
Oh, dude.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Who is this Russell Peters I hadn't heard of until I met you?
Russell Peters is definitely the most famous South Asian stand-up comedian in the world. Like, there's no doubt. He's a Canadian comic who toured Canada for years. One of his stand-up specials in Canada went viral, became huge in the U.S. He's already had a great career in Canada and became this global sensation. Basically, there are scenes all over the world that have been created basically because they saw Russell Peters perform. Wherever there are South Asians around the world, and we're everywhere, Russell Peters has been there, and he's just a huge star. And I think, you know, Chris Rock has this great quote. He said, Russell Peters is the most famous person nobody's ever heard of. I don't know how much Russell likes that quote.
He's actually got a new special out on Netflix right now, Almost Famous. Because you guys were talking about like the South Asian comedy scene, and that was actually the first time that Harry's like, I was like, yeah, well, you guys are like Southeast Asian. And you're like, no, it's called South Asian. I was like, oh.
Yeah.
And so I just remember like being like, I need to shut up and just keep talking. And I remember you really like sort of peppering Harry with questions in a very sort of like older brother way, like sort of like, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? What do you think about this?
Yeah, I was very inquisitive. You know what it was, man? Especially in San Francisco, there's the like the Padawan Jedi relationship. Huh. So I was like, when I've told you this before, Hari, when you first did Kimmel, it was like a huge deal. And I remember Tupan Trivedi was like, dude, Hari Konnabolu just did, we emailed each other.
Really?
Yeah. And then I came down to LA and Fahim, like me and Fahim were like waiting for you in a parking lot. This was like a huge deal. I thought literally like to me, even though the year was like 05, yeah, to me it felt like the year was like 1984. I was like, he just did Late Night. His life's about to change. And Hari comes in bopping like through the parking lot and he was eating a sandwich and he's like, hey man, you want some of the sandwich? And I thought it was the nicest gesture ever. I was like, man, not only does he like want to know who I am, but he like is offering me a sandwich.
That's
big brother, true big brother stuff.
It's big brother, little brother dynamic. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, it's community stuff too. I mean, to me, that stuff is so important to feel like you're part of something bigger. And I felt like, you know, I feel like you have that too. Like you always see the bigger picture, whether it's the bigger picture with the South Asian community,
yeah,
what it means to be part of a community, what our responsibilities are, and you, me, and Kamau all have this, the idea of what is our responsibility to the larger whole? What is it that we're putting out into the world and how it affects other people?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, entertainment can be a pretty selfish thing, obviously. There's a degree of ego, a degree is being polite. And, you know, look at me.
It doesn't work without a degree of ego, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, that's one thing that Kamau and I, you know, became friends on, just the idea we have the same idea of what impact are we making in the world? What impact do we want to make? The fact that our words have value. We don't just see them as flimsy things to throw around. We're very deliberate. And so that was one thing about you that I think both of us have always really admired, is that you constantly seek. You're looking for... you're looking for the best ways to do things to make the most positive impact, and you're not embarrassed about asking questions.
Yeah, that's the thing that I willingly admit. That, you know, I'm always trying to, the people that are listening, for me, if I can get a compliment from like Hari or Kamau being like, you're in the right zone, you're doing the right thing, that's like huge. You know what it is? But it's not just like, oh, so-and-so thinks you're funny. It's you're in the right space.
Yeah.
And comedy's a weird thing because it's like we do everything by trial and error. So it's tough to get it right or to know that you're on the right side of the equation. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, getting it right is feels next to impossible. And even when you think you have a bit right,
I know,
all of a sudden there's a curveball like, oh, this has just happened. Or I guess I didn't think about how that sounds to certain people. Like you think a joke's perfect and then you're like, oh no, people are misinterpreting this.
Yeah.
So I'm getting half the laughs based on what I mean and the other half and people thinking I'm being a dick and they appreciate
it. We talked about it with your vegan soul food bit where you're like, when I did it, it was this, but then it also evolved into this.
Right.
Is it okay also, is this weird to ask, Kamau, is it okay to be like, you know how there's this big culture to be like, I refuse to say I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm a satirist. I'm a comedian. I don't say I'm sorry. But like for me, I'm like, isn't it okay? Can't you just be like, I messed up?
Can a comedian not feel pain? Can a comedian not have like, blood in their veins?
Yeah. Like,
do you know why we're laughing? We're laughing at your decency.
Right. Like,
because like, there's not, I don't think there's a lot of us.
Like there's stuff that I just don't understand. And like sometimes I'll be like, man, I didn't know that. You know, and just be like, I'm sorry, I didn't know that.
Well, I think the one thing I think about that is that as when I, you know, you said you do this in front of people and you learn in front of people. And the thing is, that's happening now is that I feel sorry for comics who are starting now. From your first set, those bits are going on like on YouTube. You know what I mean?
Oh,
everybody's sort of really in the spotlight much sooner. And I feel like I had like, I don't know, like 8-9 years where if there was a camera in the room, it was exciting. I mean, a video camera, like just like, oh my God, we're going to tape it. You know, I better do my good stuff. And so it was like you weren't used to it. And then you know, some of the stuff, I remember when I really committed to sort of like, I'm going to be political. There's jokes there. There's one joke in particular that I'm like, that I'm like, I wish I could scrub the internet of that joke because it thought it was political, but it was really just sexist garbage that I have to sort of chases me down for the rest of my life.
Am I thinking about the bit that you're talking about from Premium Blend? Yeah. Okay.
Yep. I mean, it's out there. It's out there. It's findable, and I've apologized for many times, but I know that every day somebody discovers it and goes, I thought this dude was right. So the thing I want to ask you to tie it into you, Hassan, is that when you first came on the scene and I noticed you, there wasn't a sense that I thought of you as like a guy who was going to be doing political material or socially relevant material. It was just like, this is young dude, just got out of college. He's good looking, does his sit-ups, you know, sort of like, you know, is funny. And to me, it felt like this dude is making a choice to say things because you really wouldn't have to. You know what I mean? Like, you could just.
I get what you're saying.
You know what I mean? In a very, me and Hurry have to have something to say because we don't look that great.
Stop it.
Well, you know what part of it is too, man? Like once, you know, especially with the show you're doing right now, which is, you know, you know how much I love it. You know, Hassan's doing a show called Homecoming King,
right,
which is, you know, about his childhood. I don't even know how to simplify this. It's about identity. It's about your childhood. It's about race. It's about religion. It's such a wonderful solo show.
Mal, I want you to see it so bad, man.
I know you came to Berkeley, but I was gone. I'm gonna get there. It's on the. Is it?
You'll see it. You're gonna see it.
Yeah.
But watching that
on
show
on HBO probably.
You know what's funny, man? The best compliment you gave me about that after you and Hurry brought Nina Davaluri, who was Miss America, to the thing, first Indian American Miss America. But he came and afterwards he came into the green room and he's like, I'm so glad you made a show for us.
Yeah,
and there's parts in the show where I do complete poems in Urdu, and then I translate it. But there's also parts where I'll just say sentences and I won't translate it, and you just have to pick it up via context. And the funnest part in the show for me is to see non people of color have to piece together this experience. And that's awesome to me. And then to see people of color be like, and then be like, wait, what does that mean? I got to catch up. And like, it for once, like they have to be in the know.
Yes.
And that makes me feel so happy. It's not in a mean way, but it's like, hey, our chapter to the American experience also matters. And there's a lot of just like inside baseball stuff that I talk about in terms of like. And religious conflict, caste, all these things that are with like deeply rooted in our community, to put them out and talk about them publicly. I don't know. I don't think it's groundbreaking, but I think it's just worth talking about. And I'm glad I was able to put it in.
I think the show does break a lot of ground because it is a really good melding of political and personal. Like you make it like very seamless. You know, when you're talking about, you know, difference between Hindus and Muslims and to us, which is basic 101 stuff, but to a lot of people, they're unaware of how deep that goes and what it means to a lot of different people. Yeah. And also the people of color laughing. I think all of us know, you know, Kamau, I definitely know what you mean. It's the idea of people are laughing extremely hard because there's a feeling of catharsis. Yeah. And there's white folks in the room who either aren't laughing or they're laughing with their heads and not with their hearts, and not because they don't have the ability to laugh with their hearts. It's just that it doesn't hit them the same way. They intellectually see why it's funny, perhaps, but they don't see it from their experiences because they don't have them. So they're also seeing other people let out something they can't let out, and there's something like, why is that interesting? Why does this affect them like that? I will say, like, you know, what Kamau was saying earlier, after you watch the show, you know, the idea of like, this guy doesn't need to do this kind of comedy. You know, he's a pretty kid who is a really smart really smart joker. But once you see the show, I think for anybody who does think that, there's a sense of this. You have so much depth to you, and it comes from a very personal place. Uh-huh. It comes from community. It comes from your background. It comes from family. It comes from your experiences. There's such complexity in the show, and I think, you know, and I know this about you as friends, but I think for people who, you know, don't know about you and have, you know, those assumptions, you watch that show, I think people understand this is why this dude's the way he is, you know, and I think it's rare that you get to see so much of a person from a piece of art, and I'm just so proud of you.
Thanks, man.
Before we go further, though, we should say, can you tell us what the show is about?
Okay, so the show, the way I would describe it is
it's a comedic storytelling show. So it's like a theatrical four-act show. And it's basically, the narrative arc of it is centered around the story I tell about growing up, and specifically growing up in my family, first generation Indian American Muslim kid, grew up in Davis, California. Me, my dad, my mom's still in India. So I grew up in this sort of mixed familial situation where my mom was finishing school in India, me and my dad are growing up, and then we all become a family together. My sister comes from India. Like, it's this, I call it sort of this brown John Hughes movie. And then it talks about, you know, me experiencing everything in America, me falling in love for the first time, and sort of the central cut, you know, crux of the show is about this love story about me falling in love with this girl, us, you know, falling in love with each other. And then she asked me to go to prom. I sneak out of my house and I try to go with her, and then I wasn't allowed to because of the color of my skin. So that's the gist of it. So it's this moment of when I get to the doorstep and her mom was like, you know, honey, we love you. I look over her shoulder and there's this other guy putting a corsage on this girl's wrist. And her mom was like, oh my God, honey, I love you. We think you're great. But, you know, tonight we're going to be taking a lot of photos and we have a lot of family back home in Nebraska. So we just don't think it'd be a good fit. And the whole show is centered around this idea of identity and forgiveness and race and understanding all of those things. And I sort of contextualized it around this example of, I use this very personal story about, you know, 2016, me in high school falling in love, and extrapolating it to be like, well, could 2016 Hasan Minhaj fall in love with Bethany Reed, all things being equal? Mm-hmm. And I use these personal stories as jumping off points to talk about sort of race and forgiveness and all those things. And what's cool is, through working on the show, I've been working on it the past couple years, I was able to find these really awesome threads. And one of the threads in the story is this concept called lo que akenge, what will people think? In our culture, that means what will people say or what will people think? And when I worked on it with my director, he was like, that is one of the most pervasive themes just in of the human condition. What will people think? What will people say? And I think that happens, I don't know, Kamau, if you felt that way in regards to, I remember reading your blog post about you and your wife going to brunch, like,
yeah,
what will people think or say about you and your life choices and the things that, you know, you've probably witnessed behind closed doors within your own community, and then outside, when you're in the outside world and the way people perceive you, man, it's can I curse?
Yeah.
It's like a mind fuck.
Yes.
And
yes.
To me, the whole narrative theme is centered around this idea of what it means to be a member of New Brown America. Because my whole life, I've basically felt like a mutant. That's why the X-Men have always spoke to me. Because it's like, I have this identity at home, but for the most part, if I bring it out outside, if I tell people I'm Muslim, or if I tell people I have this background, or if I tell people that I grew up with just my dad for the first 8 years of my life, and then my mom and my sister came over, people won't understand, or what are people going to think or say? And I wanted to, through the show, address the ugly stuff that happens behind closed doors in our own household, and then the things that happen when I go outside as a mutant into the world.
I mean, the mutant analogy works, because I don't think we always realize that what we have is a superpower.
Yeah.
Thick skin and the ability to actually, you know, having a double lens and the ability to explain things to different people is not something everyone has the benefit, even though it seems like a disadvantage, doesn't have the benefit of doing.
Yeah, but you know what was a mind, like, again, a mind fuck for me, man, was I remember, and this is where I really knew, this is why I started hanging out with you more. When, you know, 07, 08, like, I had just sort of graduated college, and I'm starting to figure out what I want to say and what I want to talk about. And this is why I was really like, oh, man, I think I am a mutant. When Obama was running for president in 08, and people would be like, Obama's a Muslim, and it was being used as a slur, like an insult. And then even Democratic sort of supporters and candidates would be like, well, hey, come on, don't call him that. Don't say that. You know, he's a good person. And that's when I really had to, like, I looked in the mirror sometimes and I'm like, man, is this a disease? Because I'm not a disease.
Yeah.
Like, to me, the really fucked up thing about America is so much of the dialogue is Obama a Muslim? And to me, I'm like, why does it matter even if he was?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, that's how far away we were.
And still are.
Still.
And so, Hasan, the story you told about the piece that you said about Homecoming King is about the prom. Yeah. That came out of a story on The Moth, right?
On The Moth Radio Hour, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now I had to ask Dad. Now I'm a good kid. I love my parents.
And I had seen a lot of sitcoms growing up. I watched TGIF. I figured, all right, I'm going to go home. We're going to have a Danny Tanner moment. I'm going to pour my heart out. He's going to give me a hug. Cue emotional music. Roll credits. I'm going to prom. So I was like, Dad, can I go to prom? And he was like, Hassan, me tumhara mur todunga, which means, Hassan, I will break your face. Duly noted, father. All right. Okay. So I went with option B, and I call up Beth, and I was like, look, Beth, here's the deal. I'm going to have to sneak out of the house. All right? We're going to take your dad's car. We're going to go to prom, and hopefully you drop me off early. I'm going to sneak back into the house, and if my dad catches me and kills me, well, YOLO. You know what I mean? You live once.
When you did that story in The Moth, did you think that this was like the, like, this is me? Because I remember knowing you around the time, and I remember you sort of being, because at the time I'd written my one-person show, and I remember you coming like, there was like a look in your eye like, I'm doing it. Like,
yeah.
Because like, there's a fear, again, as a comic, to sort of step into that one-person show world. Like, what are
it's
you saying?
It's considered to be so corny.
It's considered to be corny. It's also considered to be like, you're basically saying, there's a narrative around it, like it's saying, oh, you can't hack it as a comedian. You got to go do that theater thing where you talk slower.
Yeah. And you know what it was? You know, like what, just like what I basically came to, like, the past few years I've come to like several realizations. All right. So the first one, and this was said by the great Paul Provenza, man, like, again, I'm so grateful that just some of these older comedians that I think are really brilliant have actually been nice to me, because if they weren't, my life would be completely different. But Paul basically said, he's like, look, man, with stand up, you can basically play notes A through M. Mm. But if you go into the theater space and you do a one-man show, you can play notes A through M and N through Z. There's parts where you can cut to a diagram, or there's parts where you can sometimes just have long stretches where there are no laughs, where it's all exposition or explanation. And that's considered still good.
Yeah.
That was the first thing. And I was like, man, there's that first part. The second part, I just felt like, when I am fighting against the two-drink minimum, there's no value for personal equity. Like, when I put my personal skin in the game, I could tell when I'm doing it at clubs, people are like, get to the joke.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, this is my own shortcomings as a comedian. I don't have the ability to walk on water the way Chappelle does. Chappelle has the ability to do stand-up and then do long monologues.
Yeah.
And then go back to stand, and it's like fluid and seamless. He never has to leave the microphone. For me, I used to have this web series called The Truth. I would have to refer to diagrams or video clips. Like, I'd have to play off of things. I needed other weapons in my arsenal. And I don't know if that's a bad or good thing. There's just a limit to my superpowers. I needed more things in my utility belt, and the theater space allowed me to do it. The third piece was this, is I had to make my bed and sleep in it and come to the realization that I am not a wig comedian. Mm. What I mean by that is, there are some, like, I would go to some comedy shows and there were guys that could get up there and just be like goofy, just straight up goofy. And I realized, I was like, to me, I'm not good at that. Like, I'm good at showing how the world is insane. I don't need to put on wigs to be like, this is crazy. I'd be like, the world is fucking crazy. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I have no desire to put on a wig when, like, the life is a sketch. Mm-hmm. Like, there's things that happen, and I'm like, really? Clown lives matter?
Yeah, everybody. Clown lives matter is apparently a thing. Apparently, after, I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to the internet, there's a whole thing with clowns showing up in places, like actual real clowns showing up in places and creeping people out. Maybe it's an urban legend, who knows? But the clown community of Tucson, Arizona organized a Clown Lives Matter march. It was going to be on October 15th in reaction to the reports of quote-unquote killer clowns terrorizing communities and also going rampant on social media, blah, blah, blah. Anyway... That wasn't a good idea.
No, Jordan Jones, a professional clown actor at Screamland Farms in Maryland, who founded the movement, Clown Lives Matter, insists that the movement was meant to be, quote, a positive thing.
Yeah, the rally was canceled after, people came to their senses.
I get it, you're clowns. You gotta wear a white face, but you gotta be that white?
Like, reality is a fucking sketch.
Yeah.
So that, when I came to terms with that, I'm like, maybe that's a strength too.
Yeah.
You know, just because I can't do maybe an SNL audition doesn't mean I can't be useful or resourceful in other ways.
Let me also say just like there are things that are restrictive about stand-up, but I will say this, watching Kamau do his legendary solo show, the W Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism Within an Hour.
The Quiet Legend.
I remember he was playing at the New York Fringe Festival, and I was hanging out with him at some meeting with a bunch of theater types, and they were talking to Kamau about how incredible his plays and how he like did things they'd never seen, like break the fourth wall and interact with the audience. And and I think Kamau and I chatted about it afterwards, like the things they're talking about just stand up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They were like, Kamau, the rhythm is so well crafted. Yeah.
You
have the audience on a string. Like, yeah, those are jokes that I've done like 80 times.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Why they
yeah,
work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's how you the funny parts are so funny. Yeah, it's called stand-up comedy. How are you so comfortable with talking to people? Because I've had to talk to waitstaff who were during the show.
While checks were dropping.
I had to ask people to stop making out in the front row while I was trying to open the show in Sacramento.
Yeah.
So I feel like, you know, the thing about this that you wrote the show, when I heard that Homecoming King was coming out, I was like, this dude has a full-time job called The Daily Show. Like, and I would just remember being like, you could just sit back and relax, and not even relax, that's a hard job. I've known people who had that job, and sort of do that. So I guess a little bit, my question is, let's step back a little bit. What was it like to get The Daily Show? And what was it like to be a part of this transition too?
Man, it was just a dream come true, man. I didn't think I would ever get a chance to do something like that. So I talk about it in the show, like what it meant, because one of the themes I talk about is like my relationship with my dad and like really how hard it is for immigrants to understand when you come to America and you come to the craps table called the American Dream. To roll comedian is a really, really, really irresponsible thing to do.
Preach.
You know what I mean? Like,
preach.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, like, I even think about it now. Like, if I had kids, would I want them to do it? I'd be like, no, it's really, really, really difficult, you know? And the older I get, the more aware I am, especially when I go visit my cousins back in India, of the privilege that I have. And I'm like, man, I have so much privilege, and I really, really did. I could have really thrown it all away.
And I mean, yes,
it worked out, though.
It is working out. It's working out great. And I remember when you got The Daily Show, I was like, oh, yes, that totally makes sense. But then to get The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and then to suddenly find out Jon's leaving and Trevor's taking over.
Yeah. Like, that was wild.
That had to be like, wait, I just got here. I was just like, I was just settling in.
I told Jon this. I was like, being on the show was like playing on the 97-98 Bulls.
Yes.
I got to join the team for the last hurrah. Like,
yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
I was like Jed Bushler. You know what I mean? I got to just like come in.
As long as you didn't miss your, free throws, you could be like, yay, we won the game.
Yeah. People always go, they're like, it must have been so hard to be on the show. I'm like, no. It was like Jon Stewart's last year. Everybody's going crazy. Like, it's Jon Voyage. Everybody loves him. You know, but it was what the one thing that was cool, and I would say like is an invaluable thing, was watching him work. And what was cool, I got to see it firsthand, is that genius and kindness aren't mutually exclusive things.
Ooh.
And man, for the longest time, I remember when the Steve Jobs, you know, book came out, everybody was like, you have to be an asshole to make it. And like, you know, just this Kobe mentality of like, you got to be a dick to be great. And the fact that to see the way he worked and to see the way Colbert works and have these guys come by, Oliver, same thing. Like, these guys are incredibly nice, gracious. They're good to their significant others and wives and children. Like, and they're not mutually exclusive concepts. To me, that was really, really inspiring, because I also want to be a good dude the other 23 hours of my life.
Mm-hmm. And especially as a dude who's married and you know, I'm sure that you may be thinking about a family. It's like, you don't want to come home and be an asshole at work and then come home, because you're going to be an asshole at home too. Take it from somebody who knows that when your work turns you into an asshole, you can't leave it at work, you know? So, yes, that's a big thing. But the thing I think I also want to highlight with about this whole Daily Show thing is that when you – the thing that – because so Jon Stewart's there. You get hired under the Jon Stewart administration. Then he leaves.
Yeah.
Trevor Noah is great, and Trevor was very nice when I was on the Daily Show to sort of highlight the fact that he'd been on Totally Biased. the thing that I think that I'm really noticing with you is that you are also a part of changing the face of The Daily Show. I remember I saw that clip of you and DJ Khaled. I was like, oh, this would have never happened before.
Correct.
Yep, like, yeah. It was just like, yep. This is meet the new boss, not the same as the old boss. And I love Jon Stewart. And like you said, we can talk about how great he is. But it was just like, That's a different look for The Daily Show. And Hasan is grabbing this by the reins and really taking it in the way he wants to.
I think that's part of the reason that people are adjusting is like it's a different show because the kids are running it now because they should.
Yeah.
That's what happens when there's a generational shift.
And like, news itself is changing. So the thing that we're satirizing is also changing. So this big like fight between the liberal media and Fox News or like us versus Bill O'Reilly, that doesn't exist as much anymore. And there are more players that are now entering the fray. I mean, one could argue that even like it's agnostic to which network you're with. It's specific personalities or viewpoints or mediums that are now, you know, that are pushing back against what we're trying to do, you know? And so you just got to evolve with that.
What is it? How has it been? Because I know that people criticizing This Daily Show because it's not John, which is an unfair burden.
I think it's unfair.
Because, like, that's, like, you're talking about the person who created this particular form.
Correct.
Who made the show what it is.
Correct.
And he's not coming back. The show is what it is now, and it's going to turn into something different and exciting. Why are we comparing it to something that it's not?
I think what's going to happen, and that just is what I personally think, is Trevor has been working so hard. And, I really had a moment where I was so proud of him. The DNC and RNC coming out of the convention coverage, and I saw the way he has carried the show and carried the show those 2 weeks. I was so impressed, and I'm like, no, this guy really has it. And he has other things. I think every person who helms a show, and Kamau, you probably felt this when you know your host, you currently have a show, and when you had your other show, it's always been you shape the show. It's like every host is a quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Even now with your show, Hari, it's like
it's a TV pilot, man.
But still, every quarterback has different things in their arsenal. Whether it's like you know some can scramble better, some can like just do set plays within the pocket. But those are strengths. Trevor has these amazing strengths that he can do. He can speak seven languages. He can do different impressions and voices, and he can tell longer stories at the desk. That's a strength that when people are trying to compare it to Stewart isn't fair. It's two different quarterbacks.
Yes.
Yes.
And it's like, enjoy this style.
Yeah.
You know?
I remember when Trevor got sick and he had to take a day off and he was in the emergency room.
Yeah.
When he came back and he was talking about his experiences for the first time and with American healthcare and being in an emergency room, nobody else could do that.
You know, a lot of people ask me, they're like, hey, Trevor, what's it going to be like commenting on America if you're not from America? And I was like, well, I'm going to have to experience America. And what better way than enjoying America's healthcare system for myself? Yeah, it was an interesting experience going to the emergency room. I'm not going to lie. I don't know if emergency room is the right term because they make you wait. I feel like there should be two rooms, a room for emergencies and a room for people who can fill out forms. Because I'm there and I'm filling out my form and the lady's like, can you fill out the form? I'm like, what? No, I'm dying. And she's like, yeah, but I need you to fill out the form first. And I'm like, but I'm dying. She's like, well, I need information. I'm like, what more information do you need other than the fact that I'm dying?
Nobody else could have had the story he had and share it the way he shared it. And for all the discussion of, well, he's not this, he's not that, no one else could have done that.
Yeah.
Nobody gives you that perspective. So I feel like the people who are watching, watch something else if you don't get what this is, and then come back to it and see how you feel.
I think when we look back on this like 5-6 years from now, when you think about a guy who's 32, 33 years old to take over this chair, when we look back on this, when Trevor's like 38, 39, when he, you know, 40, people are going to be like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Can you believe this kid did that?
Yeah.
He took that seat, took all this heat. But what's awesome is again, he's like super aware of where he's come from and how far he's come. So like to him, he's just like, there's no blog that can ever hurt me as bad as, you know, witnessing apartheid with my own eyes. So
that is an intense sentence. Your blog's
funny.
Not as intense as apartheid. Good point.
Yeah. I was going to ask, like, you know, what has it been for, like, for him? And after you said that, I'm like, oh, he's fine.
Yeah.
Oh, he'll be fine.
Yeah. It's like, your analysis lacks the blistering critiques that we wanted. He's like, yeah, I was also born a crime. So I don't know what you want me to do. Like,
I remember when I had totally biased. I remember reading an article from that was an interview with John. I think somebody sent it to me because they could tell I needed some inspiration. That John said it took him 2.5 years to get the show from Craig Kilborn to where he wanted it. And so I feel the same thing with Trevor. Like, this dude, if John got 2.5 years, just it was a different era where nothing was meant to go viral and nobody was looking at it in the same way. And also, there were no expectations for The Daily Show. But I feel like I totally can see the direction that, after 2.5 years, it'll be much closer to being the thing he wants it to be if it hasn't arrived yet. Yeah.
Yeah, I can already see it, man. He is becoming the person and he's making the show that he wants to make. I'm proud of him, man. I think everybody else is going to catch up, but I'm proud of him.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about Trevor taking some heat. I mean, certainly you got a lot of love and took a lot of heat for what you did at the Radio and TV Correspondents Association dinner, which is not the White House Correspondents Dinner.
Uh-uh.
This is in front of
Congress.
People ask me, like, why don't you do the correspondent? I don't know that I'd want that gig. Were you excited to get that gig, or was it like, I better take it because it's an honor to be nominated?
Yeah, to me, I'm like, they asked me, I'll do it. And then I realized, I was like, oh man, I got to do this. Yeah. Everybody's told me that these things are so hard and you never win. And so this is also like, it's kind of a benefit of like, I'm a thousandaire. I got nothing to lose. Like, I still bank at Wells Fargo despite the scandal. This is sad. It's a sad truth. I do. But you know what I mean? Like, it's like I look at it this way. It's just like, I'm not famous enough to lose anything by doing this.
Right.
So it's like, if at worst I do this and nobody cares, I'm like, I'm pretty much where I'm at. At best, it goes well and cool. I can be proud of myself and I can put that as an accomplishment.
Well, the heat wasn't for you doing it, right? The heat was for the fact you went off on the lack of gun control.
Yeah.
And I watched it. I'm like, to call it a rant is unfair because there were jokes in it.
Yeah.
It's just in that audience with them being like, what is he talking about? Why is he blaming us?
It felt very much like Colbert School at the Correspondents' Dinner. Like, there's jokes here. You may not be laughing, but people at home are laughing.
They're certainly. Because I'm hearing it like at home on my computer. I'm like laughing my ass off.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because you fucking nailed him.
You guys are incredible, Fox News. And you guys are in New York, where I'm based out of. The enemy walks amongst us. And we're only 5 blocks away from each other. Daily Show, Fox News. And every morning, I have to watch you guys. It's the same thing. Kill them. Bomb them. Stab them. USA. 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 And I have to walk past you guys during lunch. And I'll see all these Fox News employees leave their building, cross the street, walk past me, and then line up for halal chicken and rice. And I'm like, oh, racist Randy just wants that red sauce. I love it. I love that your brain can be racist. Your body will just betray you. I love that. I love that all morning they're just like, Mexicans, all lives matter, Arabs, 1201, shawarma time. I love that so much. I don't even know how to pivot here, to be honest with you guys. What we saw in Orlando was one of the ugliest cocktails of the problems that we still see here in America. A cocktail of homophobia, xenophobia, lack of access to mental health care, and sheer lack of political will. And all of us satirists, we've all been yelling out, crying out for change. But the sad reality is that we are all complicit in what happened.
I remember looking in the crowd. My wife was like so nervous. And as soon as I finished, I got off stage. But look, I give Larry a lot of credit. Larry was like, I remember Larry saying something like in an interview being like, look, they're never going to invite you back.
Larry Wilmore.
Wilmore, right? And Larry goes, they're never going to invite you back anyways.
Yeah.
So say what you say. There's no like reigning champ when it comes to the White House Correspondents Dinner.
No. Yeah.
Two, the amount of time I spend like reading and learning about politics, I'm just like, when you learn about Mitch McConnell and Trey Gowdy and these guys, I'm like, I don't want to crush for them. Like if that's funny. If I'm getting applause breaks for Mitch McConnell, I've failed.
Oh, wow.
I'm a loser. Wow. Like, Kamau, like, please, like, hurry, give me Padai. Like, slap me, dude. Like, I'm the worst. So I'm like, I'm not trying to be your friend. Like, so I, and then when you, I've spent all this time, you know, I did all the analysis and research. I'm like, wait, these guys spent like 6 hours a day fundraising? I'm like, this is bullshit. You guys are telemarketers that went to Harvard. This is like such nonsense.
Wow.
And so to me, I'm like, look, it's going to, whether it's going to go well or go not go well, nobody watches the Congressional Correspondents Dinner, number one.
Until you did.
Number two, it's, I guess I didn't think that would happen. But two, it's on C-SPAN 3, you know?
The so, Ocho. You're the best. It's on C-SPAN, the Ocho.
Yeah.
You're the best thing that ever happened to them.
Yes. It's there. I don't know if there's a huge audience of people watching it, but it's like, it's there. And then three, I was like, it's also the Correspondents' Dinner that has none of the glitz or glamour. The silver lining to it was this, was that Orlando happened 3 days before.
Right.
And to me, I'm like, all right, I would be remiss, like, if I, again, would approach you guys as my brothers, Hari and Kamau, to be like, yeah, I went up there and I just did some jokes about Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Right.
You guys would be like, that was it? You looked at the guys...
Yeah,
who literally were responsible for No Bill, No Break, or, you know, all this stuff, and you just didn't say anything?
To be fair, so, I think I'd be like, I get it, man. That's got to be a hard room. I think the pressure you're feeling is, but here's the, I'm super proud of what you did and super excited about it and shared it. That pressure that you're feeling is really, and I do this to myself all the time, it's internal pressure that you're putting in somebody else's mouth because it feels better coming out of somebody else's mouth. You know what I mean? Like, it's like,
we would have been proud of you either way. I was just the fact you're there,
dude. I'm proud of you since Goatface. So like, I'm like,
oh, thanks,
like, I'm just thank like, you, it just, this is all. But I do, because sometimes I feel like this is the thing that happens to me. I've sort of learned that, like, that feeling is basically your whatever is inside of us that makes us want to be the kind of comedians are is like that spirit going, are you really the kind of comedian you claim to be?
Yeah.
Are you really? Yeah. And then it's like, and you have to answer that bell. And I feel like that sometimes it happens to me, like, well, it would be easier not to do this, but then I'm not the comedian I claim to be. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to let you go because you're a very busy person, but I have one more question I'd like to ask you.
What's that?
The other thing that you, the space you have to claim that we sort of alluded to is the space as a Muslim American.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember you and Reza Aslan wrote a letter together. Sort of a letter to Muslims, right? Is to Muslims.
Correct.
Under,
yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So just talk about what it is to be in that space, to be, like, you know, on The Daily Show in that space, prominent in that space with the way this country, you know, the rhetoric around Muslims in this country.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I don't know if you felt this, Kamau, like, you know, as like a black male where there's stuff that you personally feel. Like, living in this country, there's things that you feel that you want to handle within the community itself, and then there's things that you want to handle outside in the outside world, the way the outside world treats you. Those are three very specific things.
Yeah.
So, like, let's go with the first prong, the stuff that happens behind closed doors. When the SCOTUS decision happened and gay marriage was legalized, me and Reza Aslan, one of the things that we noticed, and Reza is an amazing author and writer, now television producer. One thing that we noticed, and it made me really mad, is it was crickets on Facebook. Mm. All these kids that I grew up with, all these people that I knew growing up from Sunday school or from the community, aunties and uncles, silence. It was one of the biggest, let's be honest, it was a Plessy versus Ferguson. It was one of the biggest legal decisions of my personal lifetime. And we're not going to say anything as a marginalized group. It made me so mad. I'm pacing back and forth in my room. I call my sister. I'm like, I want to say something. And she was looking out for me. She's like, if you say this, you know, a lot of the people that you grew up with that are like super conservative or super religious are going to be like, why are you promoting gay marriage? You know the traditional stance on it. And I'm like, I don't believe gay people are sinners. I just don't believe it in my heart. And I think as Muslims, as a marginalized group, we are hypocrites if we don't see this rising tide that's lifting their boat as a benefit to our boat. So the same freedom that lets us pray at the masjid safely allows them to get married. So support it, retweet it, like, be proud of it. By the way, number two, they stand in solidarity with us.
which is so amazing. And I've done this. I've used that same logic with the Sikh community too. We have to stand for them because they always stand for us. It's important. And me and Reza, we penned this letter to be like, you cannot be silent. You have to speak up. Silence is not an option. And I got some heat for it, but I also got love for it. I got a lot of love from Muslim friends that are gay. I have a lot of, you know, gay Muslim friends being like, thank you so much for expressing that. And it was one of those things where in the moment, I didn't know how it panned out, but it was, again, one of those things where I just felt like I had to lead with my heart and just throw down. That's inside my community. The second prong is like the way I personally live my life. There's stuff that I grew up with being Indian and Muslim, and there's just really ugly things that I've seen that's happened in the Indian community where this sort of tribalism exists, and I think I've heard in a lot of communities, in the Latino community as well, and in the Black community, like light skin versus dark skinned, or people, you know, Africans versus African Americans. So we have all these like Hindu Muslim conflicts, Sunni Shia conflict, also like provincial conflicts of like Gujarati versus this. And the way I've sort of had to marry that is like I've treated my life like this. Life is like biryani. You move the good stuff towards you, and you push the weird shit to the side.
For those of you who didn't get it, look it up and then start laughing, because that's the best thing.
Biryani.
That is the best thing.
Biryani is our gumbo. And if you have biryani, it's like there's like black balls, there's like acorns in it. I'm like, why the fuck are there acorns in this? Move the acorns. The acorns to me is like our like... acorn is caste system. Why the fuck are we still adhering to caste system? Acorn is like... we're going to be against gay people. Come on. Push that weird shit to the side. I'm not doing that anymore.
Jesus.
And then the good stuff is like respecting your elders, like being good to your parents. Like, you know what I mean? All that stuff I look at very fondly and proudly, right? And then the third prong is like, and this is like the toughest thing, is basically living my life as a Muslim American. And so I swivel between these two things, right? There's times where I'm like, I got to understand that like me, Hari, you, like we basically have to be like the Dick Gregories. Like we have to be the leaders of like what Russell did. He was like, he did the kebab circuit and then he broke through and then he became a global sensation, and we keep sort of moving the needle forward. There's that element of it. And then there's also this element of like, I'm trying my hardest. You know, I'm only 31, but I'm trying my hardest to like be brave and have audacity, because sometimes I also like, I put my head down and I do this thing that my dad does and a lot of immigrants do, where you just work hard, you put your head down, you get a house in the burbs, and you live with the cards that are dealt with you. And I think a lot of immigrant parents feel like, you know, if you live in America, you pay this American dream tax, where like if you come to America, you're going to endure some racism, and if it doesn't cost you your life, well, hey, you lucked out, you pay that check. And for me, that's the way my dad thinks. But for me, I'm like, no, I was born here. Like, I have the audacity to be like, no, I'm in honors gov. It says right here, like, all men are created equal, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. I'm going to fight for that. And I'm going to try to move the needle forward a little bit. And I want to have the audacity sometimes to be like, I want this. And I don't care if a Muslim person hasn't done it or an Indian person hasn't done it. I'm going to get it because I deserve it. You know, I'm the bird. I'm not the cage. I'm not just, you can't just identify me by my name, Hassan Minhaj, or the fact that I'm in this cage. I also have a shit ton of merit and something to offer. So don't confine me by that too. I fight for both of those things. And the pendulum constantly swings between the two.
Man, I am so ridiculously proud of you. Yeah. I think, come out, you would say the same. I think every time we see you do something, you know, that's something we talk about, like, he's doing this, or that's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, I just want to say, and the thing I know about you is like, this is just the beginning. We're still at the very beginning of this. And, you know, I look forward to what comes out of this, because I just feel like, you know, like I said, a lot of people would get to The Daily Show and be like, I'm good, but it's clear that you have bigger visions for yourself than that, and bigger visions for your career than that, and also more important work to do. Not The Daily Show is great, but clearly you have a bigger scope than that, and I'm excited to see what happens.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, man. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, this is so fun, man.
Kamau, what did you learn today?
I've learned that there is absolutely an unbroken line from sports teams denigrating a race of people through their name and through their mascot, all the way through the Dakota Access Pipeline water protectors. I learned that there's something called Native American Facebook. I knew there was Black Twitter, but now I know there's Native American Facebook.
That's very excited. When he was talking about like the Indian internet, I was going to say, well, but I also, and then I'm like, nah, you know what? not the time to mention.
I learned that the word Wahoo doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, yeah. It's
just a bunch of nonsense. Just a bunch of white man's nonsense.
You know it's bad when there's a website that's nonsense called Yahoo, and then there's a drink that's nonsense called Yoo-hoo, and then they created a name for an indigenous person named Wahoo. Chances are it's not a good sign. We learned that Hassan likes to describe himself as a mutant because he's able to hold multiple identities, and sometimes that's difficult because you feel like you have this inborn weakness until you find out later that it's actually a superpower.
Kind of like your superpower to make everybody feel a little bit sad.
Is that a superpower? When do I discover that? At what age do I figure out that's actually a superpower? What did you learn, Kamau?
I learned that even if you're a comedian, it's okay to say I'm sorry.
Yeah, we kind of knew that, but it's important to point it out just because, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I didn't get something. It doesn't make you less of a person or less of a comedian. In fact, it allows you to fix the thing and make a better thing.
Yeah.
I also learned that solo shows allow performers to convey more points and information to audiences, and the theater space gave Hassan more tools in his utility belt. I think, you know, I also got to see that with your performances, Kamau. Like, you are able to do so much more when you're not handcuffed by, you know, joke, I'm drunk, bachelorette party, birthday.
I like that. That's going to be the name of your next album.
Drunk, joke. Yeah,
I'm drunk, bachelorette party, birthday. I learned that if you make Mitch McConnell laugh, then you're actually not doing a good thing.
Oh, I loved when he said that. I mean, that's right. You should make the people you want to laugh laugh, and pieces of shit should be reminded that they're pieces of shit.
Exactly. There goes Mitch McConnell coming on the podcast.
Oh, we lost Mitch McConnell. Mm.
Well, that's going to do it for today's show. Thanks again to Hassan Minhaj for joining us. You can find more of his work at HassanMinhaj.com, where you can find out more about his show, Homecoming King. And you can find him on Twitter at HassanMinhaj. That's HassanMinhaj.
I think you can also see him almost every day on The Daily Show on Comedy Central. I think.
Right. And thanks to all of you who have commented about the show on Twitter using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive. We've gotten some good feedback and good show ideas. Keep them coming.
And if you haven't done so, hit the subscribe button on whatever you're using to listen to this, and maybe think about leaving us a nice little review. It's super helpful to spread the word for new shows like us. And if you love what we do, why don't you check out some of our other work? I have a new album out on Kill Rock Stars called Mainstream American Comic, which you can get everywhere. I'm also on tour. I'll be in Toronto on November 4th. I'll be in New York City November 5th. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, November 6th. Boston on November 12th. November 17th to the 19th. I will be in Bloomington, Indiana at the Comedy Attic hanging out with Kamau's mom.
That's right, you will be.
Yep.
Put her on the list.
I will. November 20th, I will be in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I got a bunch of other gigs too. Just go to HariKundabolu.com to find information, or more realistically, type in Hari and the word comedian on Google and you'll find me. Also, college kids, if you love our show, you can bring Kamau and I to your campuses. We're available for money.
And I've got two other awesome podcasts. One, Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. And two, my live radio show and podcast on KALW, Kamau Right Now. We just did a new episode last week. Check it out. And also, I have a new album out on Kill Rock Stars called Semi-Prominent Negro. You can get my album at the same place you get Hari's new album.
Also, if you get a chance, I'm one of the new co-hosts on The Bugle, replacing John Oliver, because apparently he has a television show. So you can check that out as well. Politically Reactive is a production of First Look Media and distributed by Panoply. The team includes Nick Borenstein, Lisa Langang, Erica Mu, and Max Jacobs. The show is engineered by Ted Muldoon. Thanks for additional help today from Laura Flynn.
And thanks again to Hassan Minhaj for joining us today. Thanks again to Vince Gregoric and Sterling Holy White Mountain for joining us on the phone. You can check out Vince's work at Cleveland Scene, and you can check out Sterling's awesome blog at ESPN.com.
Thanks to Argo Studios in New York and Northgate Studios in Berkeley. And thanks to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show.
Panoply. When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.